Our next topic is particularly timely. It covers the geographical and contractual limitations on patent exhaustion, and it's really relevant because of the recent developments in the Lexmark case. And here to talk about the topic and that case is Winslow Taub, who is a partner in Covington's San Francisco office, where he focuses his practice on patent litigation, primarily for clients in the high technology space.
Thanks, Jason. Good morning. So this talk is going to focus on two specific aspects of patent exhaustion law. The first is the extent to which you can limit exhaustion by contract. This is not about implied license. This is specific to exhaustion. The second is the extent to which sales in other geographies that are not subject to U.S. patent laws can exhaust U.S. patent rights. When we were all meeting to put together the agenda for this conference, this was possibly going to be more or less a settled set of questions, but of course the Supreme Court threw a wrench into the works last Friday, granted cert in the Lexmark case, and both of these issues are before the Supreme Court for hearing this term and for argument this term. Actually, to advance, is there a clicker? Up here. Great. So just to kind of ground the talk, we'll talk briefly about the legal standard for exhaustion, some of the common fact patterns that come up in exhaustion cases, and the two historical exceptions that are at issue in the Lexmark case. Talk a little bit about Lexmark versus Impression Products, what's at stake both factually and also the larger issues that are argued by both sides. Talk a bit about the Federal Circuit's en banc ruling in that case, and then talk about the arguments that are right now before the Supreme Court. At the end, we'll discuss some of the implications and try to leave about 5 minutes for questions. All right, so background on the doctrine. So most recently, of course, the Supreme Court weighed in on exhaustion in Quanta. Exhaustion in the context of patents. And the language stating the legal standard is here. It's a common law rule. The key factors, exhaustion applies only to sales, at least per current Supreme Court precedent. And this is an issue, the distinction between a sale and a license of a patented good comes up a lot in the briefing in the Lexmark case. It applies only to patent rights, so it doesn't exhaust other remedies, for example, remedies for breach of contract, and that is also an important issue in the briefing. The other key factor here is that the article sold need only substantially embody patent claims in order to exhaust rights in those patent claims. So the claim does not need to be entirely practiced by use of the object that's sold, or in the case of an apparatus claim, all of the limitations don't need to be present in the article sold. That article need only substantially embody the patent claims. The common law rule in patent law has been around for quite a long time. The first case discussed in the briefing and also in Quanta was Bloomer v. McEwen in 1853. And just briefly on the facts in Quanta, there was a chip that was sold, which was certainly a large part of patent claims that were argued to be exhausted. Intel was the seller of the chip, was not itself authorized to combine that chip with third-party components to make a device that practiced the claim, but it was authorized to sell the chips, and the purchaser of the chips made the combination that gave rise to patent infringement. The Supreme Court found that the patent rights were exhausted and no infringement claim could be brought against the purchaser of the chips because the chips themselves substantially embodied the claims that were alleged to be exhausted. So some common fact patterns that come up in exhaustion cases, the basic idea in many of the cases is that there's some alleged mismatch between the item sold or its price and the scope of patent rights that are exhausted by the sale. One example of this is what we just discussed in Quanta, where the item sold is only a component of what the patent covers. The argument that would be made is the amount of monopoly profit that can be realized on the sale of a component may be different from the monopoly profit that could be captured for the entire claimed article. A second fact pattern is the exhaustion argument is asserted by an entity other than the entity that purchased the product. This came up in the Helfrich patent licensing case where there was a portfolio licensing program on patents related to sending text messages to phones. The text messages included a link that allowed you to retrieve additional information. All of the phone makers in the United States were licensed under the patent portfolio, and there were a set of claims reading on phones that were configured to receive this information and to then retrieve additional information when a user selected a hyperlink. The patent licensing entity then sued the content providers, so newspapers and other sites that send out these text messages. Those content providers said these patent rights are exhausted because all of the phones that are out there actually being used to receive these text messages and download the content are licensed, and all of these claims that are asserted against the content providers require the use of one of these licensed phones. The Federal Circuit rejected this argument. The opinion is a little confusing, but one of the key principles was that the entity asserting a defense of exhaustion actually hadn't acquired any product that had been the subject of an authorized sale. The content providers didn't own the phones. It was their customers receiving the text messages that owned the phones, and therefore found not to be exhausted. So that's another fact pattern. A third here is the sale is made in a market where monopoly pricing is unavailable, and this is relevant in Lexmark, and this is for foreign sales, for example. So you might imagine a company with worldwide operations in the United States, because they have patent protection, they're able to charge a price that includes a monopoly component. In other jurisdictions, they can't because they don't have patent rights there. And the concern here is if those goods are then imported after being sold at a lower price overseas, the company is competing with itself in the United States market and has to maybe lower its United States price below what it normally would be able to realize because it has to deal with foreign products that were sold more cheaply. One other set of common facts in exhaustion cases is, and these are in recent cases, is where a method claim is asserted. In Quanta, the argument was made that exhaustion of a method claim is impossible. That has since been settled. It can be exhausted where the device that is sold embodies or substantially embodies what's required to perform the method. And this has come up in a number of other decisions recently. Coirig dealt with the combination of a coffee brewer and the little K-cups, and LifeScan was about blood glucose monitors and test strips. And finally, there's this question of the difference in exhaustion law between a license grant and a sale. This came up in a Supreme Court case, at least indirectly, the General Talking Pictures. The basic rule is it is permissible to, through a license, grant limited license rights and reserve the right to assert patent infringement if the license terms are violated. So that stands in contrast to at least what most of the parties in Lexmark argue happens when there's a sale, notwithstanding whatever reservations you try to make of your rights for the article post-sale. At least most of the people and parties arguing and amici arguing in Lexmark say that it's irrelevant what you try to reserve. All of your patent rights are exhausted at that point. All right, so two historical exceptions that are at issue in Lexmark. The first is the so-called Mallinckrodt exception. This is where there has been a clearly communicated lawful restriction on post-sale use or resale. So to unpack that a little bit, the restriction per Mallinckrodt and Federal Circuit cases that have followed it has to actually be communicated to the purchaser. It has to be a lawful restriction. So past Supreme Court cases that have struck down such restrictions deal with things that, for example, violate the antitrust law. So there are requirements for resale price or tying arrangements where the purchaser is required to purchase non-patented articles for use in combination with the patented article that's sold. The second exception, and this is the Jazz Photo Corp exception, is for foreign sales. And this is a more recent Federal Circuit opinion. Here again, the argument is if you've made a foreign sale, then you haven't benefited from your U.S. patent. You haven't been able to charge a monopoly price, and it would be unfair to exhaust your U.S. patent rights as a result of that. You may notice that there are a couple of, putting aside the specific arguments that are made, there are certain types of sales that give rise to exhaustion issues most frequently. One is where there's a component sold. That's the Quanta example. The second is where there is a substantial market for refurbished goods. So Lexmark, as we'll see, involves printer toner cartridges. We all know as consumers of those that they're expensive, and there are lots of services that allow you both for toner and also for inkjet cartridges to get them refilled, and that's a lot cheaper than buying a new cartridge. So where those types of markets exist and where the original seller would really like to sell more of the original items and or do their own refurbishing and reselling, that's where these exhaustion issues tend to come up in litigation. So and Lexmark, again, is one of these cases that involves printer toner cartridges. So let's talk a little bit about the Lexmark case. So Lexmark was obviously very aware of exhaustion law and some of the arguments that could be made. What it did to tee up a nice fact pattern for its litigation was it has a pricing program that distinguishes between toner cartridges that can be resold and refurbished and those that can't. And there's a difference in price of around 20% between cartridges that, by contract, the purchaser is obligated to return to be refurbished, and cartridges that, once bought, can then be resold and refurbished. It's sort of like buying a phone that's unlocked versus locked under cellular data plans. So what Impression Products did is ran the stop sign on this, and in the United States, it purchased cartridges that were marked as being single use and refurbished them and resold them. It also abroad purchased both types of cartridges and refurbished them, imported them into the United States, and sold them, giving rise to the patent infringement action. And the arguments made sort of policy-wise, both by the patentee and by the accused infringer, are as follows. The patentee argued that the ability to price discriminate in the U.S. market and decide which patent rights are conveyed as part of a sale is efficient. It allows consumers to purchase cheaper products that don't come with the full sort of exhaustion of patent rights, or to buy the more expensive product if they want to have the flexibility to do other things with it after the purchase. The second argument is because of the foreign sales and also because of the possibility of a secondary market, it's impossible to maintain monopoly pricing in the United States, at least for certain types of goods, if it's very easy to have the used goods refurbished and resold, therefore competing with the patent holder and manufacturer. And the third is a practical issue. I mentioned that the only types of claims exhausted under the exhaustion doctrine are patent claims, and it's still possible to bring breach of contract claims. The practical problem is contract claims require privity. Here, the only contracting parties are Lexmark and the purchasers of the cartridges. Impression Products has no relationship at all with Lexmark, and it would be difficult. And Impression Products actually sort of, you know, sticks the knife in a little bit in its cert petition and says, in theory, there are these contract claims, but of course, there's no privity here, so you know you can't sue us. That was the argument that they made. And it's true. As a practical matter, it's very hard for a patent holder to crack down using any sort of meaningful remedy on a secondary market absent some ability to limit exhaustion. The arguments made both by the accused infringer and also all of the amici who uniformly weighed in against the ability to sort of narrow exhaustion are there's a risk that a patentee can double recover by charging a monopoly price on the initial sale and then basically preventing any resale of the good, and therefore not requiring essentially the payment of a monopoly price for any second use of the device. One of the amicus briefs, in terms of sort of parade of horribles fact patterns, there was a brief submitted by law professors and others that talked about, well, what happens if car manufacturers in the United States sell cars subject to a restriction that prevents resale and requires that the cars be returned and refurbished by the manufacturer? That would obviously have a significant effect on the secondary market for cars in the United States, and that would be a problem. The second argument is that there's uncertainty regarding the rights of a purchaser of a good if exhaustion is limitable by contract, because you could be a subsequent purchaser and have no idea that you've acquired a product that, although initially the sale was authorized for that product, you're now potentially liable for patent infringement because there was a condition in the contract that prevented the resale to you. And then again, related to the double recovery point is just the threat to the development of markets for secondhand goods. In the Federal Circuit, en banc, the Federal Circuit reaffirmed both of the exceptions, and the language is here. The Mallinckrodt reaffirmance was predicated really on the following. The Federal Circuit did a survey, a fairly detailed survey of Supreme Court cases, and found that in instances where the Supreme Court had struck down contractual limitations on exhaustion, for the Federal Circuit, in each case, those restrictions were unlawful for some other reason than just the fact that they were restrictions. So, for example, they violated the antitrust law. Not finding any controlling Supreme Court precedent saying that a lawful restriction was not effective, the Federal Circuit said the Mallinckrodt exception is just fine. And the sort of conceptual underpinning for their reasoning is that given that patents convey a bundle of rights, the sale can likewise convey all or a portion of those bundle of rights, and absent some reason to the contrary, the seller should be free to select what it is that's sold. And on the foreign sale exception, we'll talk a little bit about the Kurtzsang Supreme Court case, which was an exhaustion case in the copyright context, but suffice to say the Federal Circuit found reasons to distinguish it and concluded that exhaustion through foreign sales in the patent context should not result in eliminating United States patent rights. So here are the principal arguments made on cert, both in favor of overturning and in favor of upholding the Federal Circuit's decision. As is often the case for IP matters, the Supreme Court asked the Solicitor General to weigh in with a brief. The Solicitor General did weigh in. On the first question about contractual post-sale restrictions, the Solicitor General agreed completely with the respondent, with Impression Products, and said that post-sale restrictions should not be allowed to defeat exhaustion, and any authorized sale of a good should completely exhaust patent rights in that good in the United States. Again, petitioner and the Solicitor General agree that remedies via contract law are still preserved. And in both cases, they acknowledge that the license of a product would allow reservation of patent rights as opposed to the sale of a product. The respondent, of course, thinks the Federal Circuit got it just right. On the foreign sales issue, most of the discussion centered on the Supreme Court's Kurtzsang case, which was a copyright case, came out in 2013. Copyright is a little different from patent law on exhaustion and first sale in that there is a portion of the copyright statute that addresses this, and this is 17 U.S.C. section 109A. Looking back at the Kurtzsang opinion in the Supreme Court, both sides, of course, argued that it supports their position. The reasoning in Kurtzsang really rested on two prongs. So one was statutory analysis, so looking at the history of Section 109A and congressional intent, and in the context of, for example, treaty obligations that the United States has. The second, though, the second portion of the court's reasoning rested on the common law first sale doctrine. The court didn't cite patent cases in this context or lean on them, but certainly included in the opinion very sweeping language about the importance of the common law first sale doctrine, the benefits that it has on the alienability of goods once they're sold. And the respondent and also the Solicitor General picked up on these and argued that they weigh in favor of a similar treatment of the common law exhaustion rule in the patent context. The respondent here, of course, thinks that Kurtzsang should be limited to the copyright context, and the Solicitor General in its brief picked up on some differences between patent law and copyright law as pertains to international enforcement. So for copyright law, per the Solicitor General's arguments, there's fairly broad international consensus on the mechanisms for copyright enforcement, and there are treaties that require harmonization of copyright law across the world. In the patent context, the Solicitor General found some examples of treaties that actually require the United States to view patent rights in different countries as being distinct, and transactions occurring in other countries, I think Australia is one example, not having any effect on United States patent rights and vice versa. So those are the arguments presented. Supreme Court has granted cert, and you know, statistically speaking, the odds of the Federal Circuit being reversed here are fairly high, both because the historical trend of the Supreme Court reviewing Federal Circuit opinions, again, the bulk of the briefs, the vast bulk, all of the amici weighed in on the behalf of the petitioner here. And if I said respondent earlier, I misspoke. But they weighed in on behalf of reversing the Federal Circuit's en banc decision. So if you had to place a bet, it's likely that one or both of these exceptions is going away. One interesting wrinkle, the Solicitor General, as to the international exhaustion issue, did qualify a little bit and said that if the foreign sale makes very clear that that sale does not exhaust U.S. patent rights, in that case, then U.S. patent rights wouldn't be exhausted. So under the Solicitor General's view, the foreign sale would presumptively be exhausting, but that presumption could be rebuttable by showing that U.S. patent rights were expressly reserved. So let's talk a little bit about some of the implications on the assumption that the law does change from what it has been and what the Federal Circuit upheld. Licensing becomes an interesting option if you're a manufacturer of a product rather than selling it. So to talk about how that might look in the context of Lexmark's business, Lexmark might attempt anyway to sell its printers, but license the toner cartridges and make that license subject to a single-use restriction and require return of the cartridge after it's completely used. There are businesses, and I'm thinking about cable providers, for example, who never sell you anything. They provide you equipment, but the equipment is always under a license, and they continue to own it. Key to all of the prior decisions, and this includes Supreme Court decisions considering exhaustion, is if, for example, a licensee makes a sale that exceeds the scope of the license grant. So if a licensee is permitted to sell under some circumstances but sells under a circumstance that's outside the license, that sale is not exhausting because it's not an authorized sale. Similarly, if a customer took one of these toner cartridges under license and then sold it to a refurbisher and that violated the terms of the license, there would be no exhaustion of the patent rights as to that toner cartridge at that point because there was never any authorized sale. As a practical tip, if you're drafting licenses and attempting to restrict this, you do have to be very careful about the field of use and making sure that there's no way to wiggle out from under it. In Quanta, for example, Intel, which was the licensee, wasn't itself permitted to make a combination with third-party components, but in the drafting of the license, there was nothing prohibiting Intel from selling the component to someone else who would make that combination. So if you're in the process of trying to keep a handle on your patent rights, that's something to consider. The second obvious point is if the Solicitor General's view is accepted, including these non-exhaustion clauses in foreign sales agreements. And the third is just to ignore patent law completely and take matters into your own hands by putting a technological impediment to reuse. This is something that Lexmark tried to do. There's logic in the toner cartridges that detect when the toner has been emptied out and disable it in order to prevent it being refilled and reused. All of these countermeasures can be hacked, and that's really what Impression Products did, is it hacked the lock on the toner cartridge and reset it and refilled it and was able to resell it that way. Better anti-circumvention technology might help there. There's also an interesting question on the international side, and I'm going to pause in a moment to see if there are questions from the audience, on the international side is what does it mean for an international sale to be authorized? One of the amici seemed to make the argument, and this was the Association of Service and Computer Dealers, that if the Jazz Photo international sales exception is overturned, then basically any products that come into the United States would be free and clear of any patent encumbrances, and we would know that we're free to use them in the United States. Well, that seems to go too far. That would sort of render what the ITC does in patent cases superfluous for one thing. But it does raise the question of what does it mean for a sale abroad to be authorized if there's no obligation, for example, to have a patent license in the jurisdiction where the article is sold. So the patent holder may have said nothing one way or the other. A good is made completely lawfully in a foreign country and then imported into the United States. The question is, under what circumstances would that be an authorized versus a not authorized sale? And with that, I'll pause and see if there are any questions about this from the audience. In the back.
So a couple of questions about interesting implications for the rights holder. One is, one way, since, as in the Lexmark case, software is more and more prevalent in almost everything that's sold. Trying to use a click-wrap copyright license to, in essence, say, you may have been authorized to the, it may be an authorized sale of the hardware, but the software that was in the hardware is licensed, and therefore, when you resell it, that's a violation. The other is one way that people try to get around this that I've seen in some patent licenses is to only grant licenses on something that actually infringes the patent claim and may do it on a claim-by-claim basis as opposed to license the article, which was what happened in the Intel case. What about those as alternatives to deal with the issue?
Yeah. So some initial thoughts, and I may ask a clarifying question on your second point, but on the first point, it's analogous certainly to what I described as being a workaround for Lexmark, where you sell the printer and license the toner cartridge, and if the combination of the printer and the toner cartridge is what's required, you at least have an argument that there has been no sale of that combination. I don't know the answer is the short answer, but I do think that if this law is changed in the way that is right now before the Supreme Court, that people are going to attempt to make use of licenses as opposed to sales, and we're going to see some litigation on that point. So unclear exactly where the line is going to be drawn. Can you clarify the second question that you had? I just want to make sure I understood it right.
So the second one goes, if you look at Quanta, the license that was involved was the license actually licensed the Intel processor,
right,
which then had an important part of the memory interface in it. The if instead of drafting the license so that the chip per se was licensed, the license was drafted that we only license that which is covered by the claim, okay, technically then the argument would be what Intel would, if that had been the license, what Intel would have sold would not have been licensed because it was not covered by the claim. And therefore, since it was not covered by the claim, there was no authorized sale.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I could imagine that being drafted in a couple of ways. You could, for example, only license Intel under certain claims if there are only certain claims that Intel is going to practice. The wrinkle in Quanta was that Intel could have made its own combination of the chip with the bus and the memory that were the other elements required. So. You could, on the license rights, though, for example, you could authorize them only to sell, a chip that practices a claim as opposed to a chip by itself, and that might get you around, the exhaustion argument, because then the initial sale would not have been authorized under the particular claims as to which exhaustion was later asserted. So, I think you're right. You could draft the license agreement in a way that made the sale of something other than what practiced the claim not authorized. And that would have been, again, with no authorized sale, there is no exhaustion and the argument can't be made later. Go ahead.
I want to point out, or I guess get further clarification, what you're talking to right here could have tremendous implications for our entire commerce and consumer products goods section in our nation. So if you use the example of cable providers leasing you the equipment, cell phones, you used to be able to sign up with AT&T or Verizon and you got the phone for free and you were locked into your two-year agreement. If we are breaking down specific sections of either patent claims or copyrightable material, what you're arguing here, or if the Supreme Court agrees with this, we could move to a situation where basically everything is on a lease. And as we get into the Internet of Things, every single device, you might be acquiring the hardware, but you're leasing the software. At which point, with the next rev change, you have a dead device. Basically, it's a brick at that point. And that would drastically change our entire commerce system.
I think to the extent that this prompts patent holders to try to hang on to their patent rights by shifting more to licenses than sales, I do think that it raises the possibility of the types of complications that you're suggesting. Historically, the types of companies that are most interested in reserving patent rights are, again, in particular, they seem to be clustered in particular spaces where there's a physical component, for example, that's reusable. So it's hard to say as a business matter how much this decision would really change companies' behavior. The distinction that you're pointing out, though, that really you can achieve the same types of transactions through a license in some cases as much as you can through a sale. And if there's a big legal distinction as to exhaustion between the two, it's gonna drive companies to favor licenses over sales. I think that's right in general, but we'd have to wait and see exactly which companies and which industries are really gonna sort of invest the effort in revamping their commercial strategy to take advantage of that. This tells me I'm done, but I think we should do one more.
To what extent is there any indication that there's willingness to look through how you title a transaction and look at the underlying reality of what that transaction is?
In the current briefing, I didn't really see much of that. The high-level point, again, of the sort of equivalence or interchangeability between sales and licenses is raised as a rhetorical point, but plumbing the depths of that, and when a court, for example, might take a look at something that is nominally a license and say, in effect, it's a sale, and therefore exhaustion applies, is really not teed up in the current briefing. But I think we could expect some litigation about that if the Supreme Court does what's expected and reverses the Federal Circuit. I think we're out of time. I want to.
With this shifting focus to contract, are we going to see a greater use of standard form contracts in the context of consumers used by patent owners to expand their monopoly? And if so, how are we using, the empirical work that in literature that we know that, no one reads these standard form contracts and all the experience we have from copyright and, the problem of consumer not assessing their rights in this kind of setting?
Right. So talking about a contract action, as a practical matter, and this is what happened in Lexmark, in many cases, there are too many customers to make breach of contract actions a practicable remedy. And the only reason they are pursuing this is there is a single entity that they can bring these patent claims against. So not totally clear that putting aside whether the form contracts actually form a binding contract, whether that's going to be a frequently used remedy when goods are sold in high volumes. But you're right. If companies turn to breach of contract as a way of
and if there is more licensing, there is more risk for consumer deception, as we know from recent work, empirical work on e-books. People think they own what they buy, but it's a license. But consumers are accepted. So.
Right, and then you need to consider whether the action is actually then likely to directly impact the consumers or whether the license will just be used as a way to argue that patent rights were preserved and allow them to bring a patent infringement action, action again against the refurbisher. So, but all good points. Terrific, thank you.